What is the human shadow? Written and read by K. Newell Plum. Taken from chapters 9 and 10 of a book called Shadow in the USA, this definition and that whole book are available in written form as free PDFs at shadowintheusa.com. Because we're not just running out of time, we're running out of world. Chapter 1. The Personal Shadow. The subconscious part of every human mind holds a whole cast full of characters hanging around backstage, hoping to land a role. All the instinctual and archetypal characters from millions of years of evolution, the entire cast of myth, tale, and dream, stand around waiting in the wings of your psyche, just longing for a chance to appear on stage. But we get typecast early on. We develop a certain role in our family of origin theater, and then we continue to play that role when we go out onto the world stage. It's actually a matter of survival. Children can't make it on their own as infants. So to please the incomprehensible adults they depend upon, children learn to hide parts of themselves before they can walk. They learn the difference between approval and disapproval before they can talk. And unless shaken up by some sort of unforeseeable disaster or a ton of therapy, human beings tend to go along all through life playing a version of the role they first learned to play in childhood. This role gradually becomes the ego. It's the face we present to the world, the way we think of ourselves, and the way others think of us, we hope. And all those parts of the psyche that won't fit neatly into this role, all those other instinctual and archetypal characters milling around backstage in your subconscious, end up in your ego's shadow. Carl Jung was one of the big three fathers of modern psychology, Freud, Jung, Adler. He began to call the contents of the mind's subconscious its shadow in the early 1900s. Jung also gave us the terms introvert, extrovert, and complex, and he classified our basic psychological tendencies, which led to those personality tests that HR departments use today. An interesting guy. 70% scientist, 50% mystic. And although his works can sound dated now, and this guy could write in Latin and use alchemical symbols as allegories, some of your work will sound dated too in another 100 years. There's no denying his lasting impact on the field of psychology. This particular concept, the human shadow, is where Jung began to branch away from Freud. Whereas Freud insisted that everything in the subconscious was about repressed sexuality, and maybe a lot of it was back in Freud's day, Jung said, no. The subconscious holds whatever you don't know about yourself, not just repressed sexuality, and particularly those things you really don't like to admit about yourself. So, Jung was using the word shadow to describe the parts of the psyche that a person doesn't want to, usually just can't, think about or acknowledge. It holds the repressed, unlived side of your normal daytime personality. It holds the things you don't like about yourself, the things you don't want anyone else to know about you, the things that don't fit into your ego's usual role. Thus, your shadow will assuredly contain negative qualities, such as envy or prejudice or cruelty. And it could even contain positive qualities if you like to think of yourself as some sort of criminal badass. But these qualities, whatever they are, stay in your mind's shadow because you don't like to, in fact, most of the time you simply can't, admit you possess them. Some parts of ourselves we like to show to others, put them out into the light. And some parts of ourselves we like to hide. We keep them in the shadows. Coming up with the word shadow for this phenomenon was a stroke of genius. It put a memorable label on a basic psychological process, and it is extremely apt symbolically. Neither the outside physical shadow nor the inner mental shadow can be smelled or tasted or touched or felt, yet both are very firmly hooked to us, whether we like it or not, whether we can see them or not. And while other people can see your shadow pretty easily, you have to turn your head around to be able to see your own shadow. There's also a nifty irony built into both meanings of the word. Whether it's a shadow cast by light in the natural world or a shadow cast by your ego, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. Some of the most vile, most grotesque acts in history have been done and are still being done right this very minute. In the name of God, which is the brightest light we've been able to imagine so far. Ever noticed how often someone at the top of the heap, famous, wealthy, powerful, gets caught doing something ridiculously lowbrow? How often celebrated evangelists or celibate priests become embroiled in sleazy sex scandals? The brighter the light, the darker the shadow. The more wonderful you think you are, the more you have to hide. The enchantments and bewitchments that occur over and over again in classic fairy tales mirror those that happen in real life. Most of us fall into an enchantment at one time or another. We identify with one type of role until we think we are a good mother, or we are a hard-working wage earner, and then we try very hard not to be anything else. We just flat get stuck in our role. As athlete, or honor student, or class clown, or thin woman, or powerful businessman, or laid-back dude, or devoted religious disciple. And deny the very existence of any part of ourselves that won't fit neatly into that role. We deny we have any desire to skip class, or eat the whole bag of cookies, or blow off work today, or hop into bed with a total stranger, or scream loudly at our children. And we usually can manage to cram all those contrary desires way down into our shadows. What contrary desires? I don't see any. That is, until we wake up one day and find ourselves doing something really stupid and totally out of character. Out of character. Out of the role we've chosen, or we're told, to play. Which was probably a fairy tale character's role from an idealized family, and so not even humanly possible. It's sad, poignant, and highly paradoxical that despite the evil increasing exponentially around the world, most of us are trying really hard to be good. There's actually a correlation between trying hard to be good and an increase in evil. Denying parts of your personality on a daily basis is called repression, and it creates another ongoing problem called regression. If I can't even admit I have certain feelings, if they shame me, or they scare me, or if they're simply not permitted in my culture, those feelings will not look the same when they do eventually slip past my conscious guard. Those feelings will have regressed. Regress is the opposite of progress. To regress is to go backwards, which means the parts of myself I just can't stand to think about will only get less human the longer I refuse to think about them. The longer I pretend not to know anything at all about a basic instinctual impulse of mine, the grosser and hairier and wilder that abandoned part of myself is going to get, like a castaway living all alone on an island, like that caveman lurking in your subconscious. What makes a bunch of good old boys who usually hang out down at the cafe go out and lynch a black man. Or beat a gay man to death and leave his body dangling from a barbed wire fence. Who does the actual torturing in a torturous regime? Or beats women for wearing fingernail polish? Who carries an AR-15 into a grocery store or a school? Were these people all born evil? Probably not. However, we are all capable of a distinct downward slide as we go through life, from repression to regression to aggression. If we wish to appear angelic on the surface, the devil inside dances. When we become absolutely certain that our way is the only way, imps start to grin. Being right at all times and perfectly flawless is simply not possible for a human being. When everyone is wrong but you, you still have some growing up to do. If we can't admit making a mistake or losing at something, can't calmly discuss important issues, when we simply will not tolerate other points of view, much less change our minds if faced with new evidence, when we are obviously much cooler or smarter or more righteous, and everyone else is obviously lamer or dumber or downright damned, that is just sheer self-enchantment, folks. In classic fairy tales, that's how the siblings act who don't find the treasure. But luckily, there's a surefire way to break this sort of ego self-enchantment. It's a fairly easy process once you get the hang of it, but you must perform step one while totally alone. Step one, stand in front of a mirror. Look long and hard at your face, which is the mask you wear for the role you usually play, and then say out loud, "Oh, man, I'm as full of shit as a clogged toilet." Step two. Keep that in mind while you go out for coffee or walk down to the pub. Step three. Repeat this process every few days. If you do this correctly, while you're out and about, you'll begin to realize that every person on earth, you, me, and that guy in the corner booth over there, is just as much court jester as wise king, just as much evil stepmother as Snow White, and that the easiest way forward for the entire human race would be for all of us to go ahead and start admitting that fact. None of us are perfect. All of us have flaws. And the sooner we can own up to that, the sooner we can get to mending our mistakes. In Romancing the Shadow, Connie Zweig and Steve Wolfe explain it this way. Quote, "Like Dorian in The Picture of Dorian Gray, we each seek to present a beautiful face to the world, a kind, courteous demeanor, a youthful, intelligent image. And so, unknowingly but inevitably, we push away qualities that do not fit this image, qualities that do not enhance our self-esteem, but shame us and make us feel small. We shove into the dark cavern of the unconscious feelings that make us uneasy, thereby creating shadow content." End quote. And this is one of the things M. Scott Peck says in Meeting the Shadow. Quote, "Sin is nothing more and nothing less than a failure to be continually perfect. Because it is impossible for us to be continually perfect, we are all sinners. Be perfectly honest with yourself, and you will realize that you sin. If you do not realize it, then you are not perfectly honest with yourself, which is itself a sin. It is inescapable. We are all sinners." Those who have crossed over the line into evil are characterized by their absolute refusal to tolerate the sense of their own sinfulness. End of quote. Chapter 2. how the personal shadow fits into the collective shadow. Whatever you have in your shadow is in there because it's a part of you. You don't want to think about it. That's why it's hidden in your shadow. But it's still a part of you, which means it has to. It will show up somewhere in your life. It is not possible to get rid of parts of yourself by simply ignoring their existence. So if there are some things you can't stand to admit about yourself, if you just can't face some of your own stuff, then you're going to see your own stuff on someone else's face. It will not just disappear. It will not simply give up and go away because you refuse to acknowledge it. No, indeed. It will start appearing in other people. You'll see it in this person and in that person. It will keep popping up in other people again and again. And all those other people doing whatever it is you don't like about yourself will look worse and worse to you as time goes by. As Vaclav Havel put it in The Shadow in America, quote, "Hate has a lot in common with love, chiefly with the self-transcending aspect of love, the fixation on others, the dependence on them, in fact, the delegation of a piece of one's own identity to them. The hater longs for the object of his hatred." End of quote. Kind of explains why we hear so much ranting and raving over the airways, doesn't it? And why it's so easy to get all hot and bothered about what other people are doing, and why we just can't seem to get off of certain subjects. James Hollis says in Why Good People Do Bad Things, quote, "Consider the convenience of knowing who the enemy is, always. If the enemy is over there, they're not in here. So I have no burden of consciousness, no obligation to examine myself." End of quote. The psychological process involved here is childishly simple. We dwell on what others are doing to keep from having to take responsibility for what we've been up to ourselves. This is called projection in psychological terms, and it happens all the time. It starts with denial, and it ends in blame. We take some part of ourselves we don't like, or are ashamed of, or don't want to think about, or can't bring ourselves to deal with, and project it out onto another person where we can see it, and then we blame them vehemently for being that way. This is not a new idea. Jesus chided his followers about pointing out little specks of dirt in other people's eyes while failing to see whole logs in their own eyes. We all grew up hearing, "Well, that's the pot calling the kettle black," or "takes one to know one," or "people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones." We all know something, vaguely, about how the cycle of denial, projection, and blame works. What we haven't yet come to grips with is how prevalent and malevolent this simple ego defense mechanism has become. In Archetypal Dimensions of the Psyche, Marie-Louise von Franz wrote, quote, "If we do not see our own shadow, we project it onto other people, who then have a fascinating effect on us. We're compelled to think about them all the time. We get disproportionately stirred up about them, may even start to persecute them." This does not mean that certain people whom we hate are not in truth intolerable, but even in such cases, we could deal with them in a reasonable manner or avoid them if they were not the projection of our own shadow, which never fails to lead us into every possible exaggeration and fascination. End of quote. Imagine a movie projector. Your mind would be the machine whirring away in that little room up at the back of the theater, and the other person would be the big screen down in front. You're creating the image, The image is actually being produced inside your head, but the other person is the only place where you can see that image. You're projecting that image onto another person. This process allows us to accuse others of having qualities we abhor in ourselves while remaining steadfastly in love with ourselves and not having to change a thing personally. I don't have a bad temper. What are you talking about, you asshole? You have a terrible temper. Here's another quote from M. Scott Peck. Quote, "A predominant behavior characteristic of those I would call evil is scapegoating. Because in their hearts they consider themselves above reproach, they must lash out at anyone who does reproach them. They sacrifice others to preserve their image of self-perfection. Since deep down they feel themselves to be faultless, it is inevitable that when they are in conflict with the world, they will perceive that conflict as the world's fault. Since they must deny their own badness, they must perceive others as bad. They project their own evil onto the world. They never think of themselves as evil. On the other hand, they see much evil in others." End of quote. And this is where it gets serious. I'm sure you've heard that denial ain't just a river in Egypt. Well, projection and blame ain't just small towns in Texas. We are not talking about a quaint practice only carried out by a few remote primitives somewhere on the other side of the planet. This cycle, denial, projection, and blame, is a basic psychological defense mechanism. It's a description of what went on at your dinner table last night. It's a description of what we each do all day long, every day, unless we're making a sincere effort not to do so, and probably a good 78.87% of the time, even then. There's no getting around the fact that human beings are now using their intelligence to project whatever they don't like about themselves onto other people, rather than using their intelligence to correct whatever it is about themselves they don't like. Shoot, we're taught to project whatever we don't like about ourselves onto other people. Children hear their parents, civic leaders, and sports stars do it every day. Try looking around for someone who's projecting their own shadow material onto someone else. Maybe blaming others for what they're obviously up to themselves. Maybe accusing others of qualities they would never admit to of themselves. Look around for shadow material being projected. It will not take you long to find it. In history, in current politics, in the news, at sporting events, on the internet, on television, in your own home, and in your own heart. Nor will it take you long to come to the conclusion that this is not some harmless procedure easily overlooked among friends. This is killing us. As Robert Bly put it, projection of shadow material causes most of the misery, injustice, and warfare in the world. And as Carl Jung wrote, learning to integrate shadow material is the single most important task facing mankind, as failure to do so will lead to the extinction of the human race. Whoa, what? Extinction of the human race? Why did he say that? He said that because we don't just project blame individually. We also project blame collectively. The really dire news is whole cultures cast shadows. A hat that looks really cool in a bar in Wyoming may not look cool at all on Madison Avenue in New York. There are substantial cultural differences between the Pacific Northwest and the Deep South, between being German and being Sudanese, between Chinese and Chilean. We're not just stuck in ego roles and family roles. We're stuck in social, historical, mythological eras, and areas. And then, in practice, we refine our differences even further by only hanging out with people inside our era and area who are the most like us. Red state, blue state. As history has shown over and over again, when enough people deny and then project the same qualities onto other groups of people, something really nasty occurs. Like inquisitions, witch hunts, exterminations of native populations, institutionalized slavery, civil wars, holocausts, genocides. Massive acts of evil simply could not be perpetrated without massive amounts of denial, projection, and blame. You can think of the human shadow as layered or tiered. There are personal layers, and there are collective layers. We each have a personal shadow that can get out of hand. For example, we tend to make fun of how other people look when we feel insecure about how we look. And then we each belong to collective shadows that can get out of hand. We will accuse another group of evil if we can't bear to look at the evil our own group has done or is doing. An excellent example of the latter occurred in U.S. history after World War II. The saturation bombing of German cities by British and U.S. forces during the war culminated in a firestorm at Dresden so fierce that people hiding in underground bomb shelters melted into liquid sludge. Then the USA dropped two atomic bombs on Japan. At Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 199,000 people were either killed instantly or died later slowly and hideously from radiation poisoning. These three events, Dresden, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, killed what historians now estimate to be 224,000 people, and not soldiers either. These were completely innocent civilians who've been going about their business in a big city. It's just gruesome. It's ghastly. It's way, way beyond what gruesome or ghastly or any other word could possibly convey. So very soon after these events, unable and unwilling to comprehend that such colossal evil could be perpetrated by their own country, citizens all over the USA, spurred on by their leaders, began to obsess about how evil Russia was and to build bomb shelters in their backyards in case of a Russian nuclear attack. I grew up with one of those bomb shelters in my backyard. I also grew up hearing stories and watching lots of movies about how badly German and Japanese soldiers acted during World War II. The 224,000 civilians who were slaughtered at Dresden and Hiroshima and Nagasaki were simply not mentioned during my childhood in the USA in the 1950s. Not by anyone. We were too busy hiding under our school desks during air raid drills because we'd been told that the Russians were commie bad guys who were out to get us. There is a me against you aspect to the personal shadow, and there is an us against them aspect to the collective shadow. And projected out onto others, both types of shadow material can do colossal amounts of harm. As Connie Zweig and Jeremiah Abrams point out in Meeting the Shadow, quote, "The collective shadow can take form as mass phenomena in which entire nations become possessed. When a minority is forced to carry the projections of a majority, the potential for great evil is activated." End of quote. Politicians use symbols and symbolic language to manipulate their populaces, because symbols and symbolic language stimulate the subconscious. They pull the heartstrings to our collective shadow ties. And we fall for it because we each have to belong to something bigger than ourselves to make it on this planet, and the scarier this planet gets, the more we subconsciously hope that whatever we belong to is really powerful, mighty, right, beyond reproach. So we all respond heartily, no thinking required, to waving flags, national anthems, simple, catchy slogans, matching clothing, or links to the past through the use of archetypal words like fatherland or motherland or homeland. Hitler was a consummate master of the symbol. The salute, the swastika, the rows upon rows of clean uniform youths singing and marching in step. Symbols like these speak directly to the need to belong to and to be protected by something bigger than ourselves, a need that lives in every human heart. In Why Good People Do Bad Things, James Hollis says, quote, "Groups always have a fluid, amorphous, but highly vulnerable group ego. And that fluid, amorphous group ego is always highly susceptible to the manipulation of a charismatic leader. Charismatic madness touches and activates the mad parts in otherwise quite sane people. Psychological contagions, shadow plagues, do occur, and few of us, if any, are exempt." End of quote. Of course, political examples of the collective shadow abound today. But we're going to look at rather old examples now on purpose. Current examples would be way too divisive. But let's make it very clear here. We are not just talking about Republicans or Democrats. We are not just talking about the USA. We're talking about how the shadow side of human nature operates at a national collective level. My examples are from the USA because that's my country, and what my country does matters to me. But if you look into any other country's history, you'll find the same things. We'd all like to believe the surface version of the fairy tale. We'd all love to live without guilt in the home of the free and the brave. But projecting shadow material on a national level is serious, deadly business. No matter which state we live in or which party we belong to, if we don't start looking truthfully at the past and dealing honestly in the present, if we don't stop muddying the waters with denial, projection, and blame, and start taking clear-eyed responsibility for our own actions, this country is not going to get through the next few decades unscathed. Nor will the rest of the world. So, some historical examples of the collective shadow. In a 2002 State of the Union address, the President of the United States call three other countries an axis of evil for selling arms to enemies and fostering terrorism. Really read them the riot act in a very rousing way. Okay, but what was Iran-Contra? Wasn't that when the USA sold arms to a country that was actually holding US citizens hostage at the time, Iran? And then didn't the USA use the profits from those covert, illegal sales to train and finance a guerrilla army, the Contras, in order to overthrow a democratically elected government in Nicaragua? Yes, it was. That's exactly what Iran-Contra means. Do you see how this works? You sell arms to enemies and foster terrorism yourself. Then you accuse other countries of selling arms to enemies and fostering terrorism to divert attention from your own crimes. The best defense is always a good offense. This is a classic example of the pot calling the kettle black at a national level. It's like name-calling on the playground, except with far deadlier ammo. And while it does let off a little saber-rattling steam and allow the USA to feel superior at the moment, railing against other governments will not solve a single problem here at home. It will not provide universal health coverage, or balance the budget, or adequately fund teachers and education. It will not curtail environmental degradation, or hold corporations accountable to their cultures. It will not lower our dependence on fossil fuels or index the minimum wage to the cost of living. Nope. That's one of the problems with slinging shadow material around at a national level. It won't get a damn thing done at home. It's just sheer subterfuge. But the more we self-righteously puff ourselves up and accuse others of evil doing, the more we can get away with ourselves. This type of thing is exactly what George Orwell meant by doublethink and newspeak in his famous novel, 1984. In 1984, doublethink was used to train the populace to be able to hold two obviously contradicting facts as equally true. Quote, "The party told you to reject the evidence of your own eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command." End of quote. Today we call this cognitive dissonance. Doublethink was used in conjunction with newspeak. This was a language with limited vocabulary and restricted grammar designed to prevent freedom of thought by reducing complex ideas to simplistic jingos. Quote, "The intention was to make everyday speech as nearly as possible devoid of thought." End of quote. This same president later gave a speech in Tbilisi, Georgia, about the glories of freedom and democracy, which was broadcast live. Everyone listening at home heard a heartwarming, cliché-filled, archetype-stirring speech. Very noble, very presidential. It would have been impossible to disagree with a word the man said. Who doesn't love freedom or want to practice democracy? And the whole speech was doublethink and newspeak. Astoundingly so. The man had not been democratically elected himself, as everyone knew. He actually lost his election, but was placed into office before all the votes in Florida could be counted by judges his father appointed to the Supreme Court with the help of his brother's state election officials. The day he gave this laudable speech in Tbilisi about the glories of freedom and democracy, his administration was actively engaged in demolishing a smaller country's sovereign government, Iraq. In defiance of world opinion, for reasons that turned out not to exist. It caused bloody chaos in that country, of course, and it turned a federal budget that was balanced when he came into office into a cripplingly huge federal deficit from which our country may never, ever recover. And guess what? The political party this president belongs to has specialized in accusing the other party of being big spenders ever since, at every opportunity. The best defense is a good offense. So, what was this president doing when he used the words freedom and democracy over and over in this speech? Doublethink. Trying to fool the rest of us? Newspeak. Trying to convince himself? Denial. The political rhetoric that we hear day in and day out neatly emphasizes our nobility, but it conveniently leaves out our shadow. And while it is slightly understandable that we swallow whatever we hear from our leaders without question, because we want our country to be right, we want our favorite talk show hosts to be right, we want our party to be right, and because we can be very good at ignoring all evidence to the contrary, while it is slightly understandable that we swallow whatever we hear from our leaders without question, that does not make it smart. Ancient Greek dramatist coined the word hubris to mean a great, overweening, invincible feeling pride that invariably causes its own downfall. Hindus and Buddhists use the words karma, which means you will experience the type of actions that you commit. Christians say, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. In the 1960s, hippies used to say, what goes around comes around, man. Put it however you want. The point's the same. Any country, any group of people who cannot admit mistakes and would rather blame the evil they do on others than change the evil in their own behavior is going to pay an astronomical price in the long run. And judging from the number of serious problems that the USA faces, constant warfare, enormous federal deficits, underfunded educational systems with no system whatsoever for the youngest among us, crumbling infrastructures, rising poverty and mortality rates, steadily worsening weather due to unaddressed climate change, lakes and oceans full of pollution and plastic, chronic racism and sexism, truly bizarre mass shootings, and political parties that cling to power by lying and obstructing rather than governing, judging by all of these things, it's safe to say that we've already entered payback stage and that it is indeed a bitch. Projection dominates our interactions because it's easier to accuse others of wrongdoing than it is to admit the wrong we've done ourselves. It is so much easier to attack others than it is to change, personally or collectively. So we go for the surface interpretation of the fairy tale. We see ourselves as the good guys and all those other guys as the bad guys who deserve whatever they get. We tell ourselves that all the monsters are on the outside. But the real monsters are on the inside, personally and collectively, which makes them hard to see. Let's close with some thoughts from others. From Mahatma Gandhi, the only devils in the world are those running around in our own hearts. That is where the battle should be fought. From Albert Einstein, unleashing the power of the atom has changed everything except our way of thinking. We need an essentially new way of thinking if mankind is to survive. From Conrad Lorenz, we just might be in time to stop the apocalypse, but it will be touch and go. From John Sanford, the task of confronting the brutal, destructive elements of the shadow has become the inescapable destiny of our species. If we fail, we cannot hope to survive. And finally, a hopeful thought from the I Ching. It is only when we have the courage to face things exactly as they are, without any self-deception or illusion, that a light will develop out of events by which the path to success may be realized. It is only when we have the courage to face things exactly as they are, without any self-deception or illusion, that a light will develop out of events by which the path to success may be realized. The end. This has been What is the Human Shadow? It was written and read by K. Newell Plum, and it was taken from chapters 9 and 10 of a book called Shadow in the USA. This definition, as well as that whole book, are available in written form as free PDFs at shadowintheusa.com. Because we're not just running out of time. We're running out of world.